Hello and welcome to The Green Room, Spectator USA's weekly life and arts podcast. This week, I'm talking to the author Robert Kaplan. 25 years ago, when many in the West were congratulating themselves on winning the Cold War, or at least not losing it, Kaplan wrote an article called The Coming Anarchy. Instead of the spread of a liberal order across the globe, he foresaw increasing instability caused by population movements, environmental degradation, and the return of history. Well, the coming anarchy seems to have come. Robert Kaplan, welcome to Spectator USA.
It's a pleasure to be here, Dominic.
Well, we're talking in the first days of 2019, and so this may be the first occasion on which someone has said to you, how do you feel about the coming anarchy as its 25th anniversary appears?
I think on the whole, I feel very good about it. I think I caught something that was true, but there were, you know, there were minor elements of the piece that proved wrong, and even one or two major elements. Basically, what I believe that nobody can predict the future in terms of tomorrow or the day after in a given country. That depends on the Shakespearean dynamics of leaders, you know, active intelligence, which very few people have. Also, nobody can predict 40 or 50 years out because there will be such technological change. It would make such a prediction mere speculation. But what a journalist should be expected to do is to make the reader somewhat less surprised by what happens in a given place in 5 or 10 or 15 years. In other words, the middle-term future. And so if you look at what I said about specific places in the coming anarchy in 1994 and what happened to them in the late 90s, the early 2000s, up until 2010, I will stand on my record as being right. And we can go through them, Sierra Leone, Cote d'Ivoire, Turkey, other places.
Yeah, you're talking about the Shakespearean dynamics as a permanent feature of political, social life. But the mood at the time in the early 1990s, the dynamic was close to that of Kant, in a sense, the end of the Cold War and great optimism about perpetual peace. Why was it that you were not one of the people talking about the inevitable triumph of liberal democracy or an American-led global system?
Because I was alienated from the elite, because my life experience was different from the elite. I grew up in a working-class background. I went to an average middle-level forgettable college. And then I spent years traveling through Africa, staying in cheap hotels, traveling through Asia. And so when I read The End of History by Francis Fukuyama, I said, this is a brilliant piece of writing. He's obviously somebody we should revere, but this is not the world as I've experienced it whatsoever in any way, shape, or form. This is a piece that is obsessed with the American and West European experience, essentially. It's not what I saw in West Africa. It's not what I saw in the Middle East. It's not what I saw in Turkey. So in terms of my personal experience system, it was different from that of the elite. And I merely reflected that personal experience system through my writing. In other words, most members of the elite, they're political scientists, they're philosophers, whatever they may be, they're politicians. I've been a reporter. That's what and a reporter is driven by what he sees or hears or smells on the ground. And unlike other reporters, I kind of migrated into analysis, you know, essentially not trusting, not seeing the limitations of daily journalism. That reporters generally, they could describe something, but they couldn't necessarily tell you what it means. In other words, they weren't analysts. And so I try to analyze the world and the coming anarchy based on what I had seen on the ground in West Africa or Egypt or Turkey or other places.
You're being a realist with a small R, in other words, based on an empirical experience in your travel.
Absolutely.
Did you see yourself, or when did you start to see yourself as being a realist with a big R, as in how that would fit into the theory of international relations?
Well, it was a process. When I was covering the Balkans in the 1980s, before anyone got there, and I saw that most people defined themselves according to which ethnic group they were. And that this was a place with significant ethnic tensions that were only being held together by the Cold War security structure. That was it. And in the Balkans, I read Henry Kissinger's first book, A World Restored, about Metternich, Castlereagh, and Talleyrand, and about the peace they wrought, not through any idealism, but through hard-nosed constructive pessimism. And I said to myself, this speaks to me. It speaks to what I've seen on the ground in a way that everything else by elites do not. And time went on, the coming anarchy was attacked, Balkan Ghosts was attacked. And I thought that what I was writing was just describing what I had seen. I didn't see it in any ideological or specifically philosophical terms. I'm describing the world not only as it is, but as it turned out to be in the 90s in the Balkans and in West Africa 5 years after I went there, etc. And I realized that the people attacking me would do it, they weren't, they didn't have, it was mere value judgments. It wasn't substantive, analytical, or repertorial challenges to what I had written. So it was mere value judgments. And then I realized I'm something I never thought I was. So then I started reading more and more and more, and I fell in love particularly with the books of Samuel Huntington and John Mearsheimer and others who were not reporters. They were men of the academy. They had limited personal experience. But for whatever reason, they had an ability to plumb the depths of the most unpleasant situations. In other words, to reach down and grab at what nobody else was willing to talk about. And that's what gave their writing so much power, in my opinion. Kissinger, of course, is more elegant in his writing. You know, he was a diplomat. He's an historian. I like to say that had he not taken the job in the Nixon administration, he would have gone on to win a Pulitzer Prize in history and would today be beloved by the New York Review of Books in the greatest of irony.
Instead of being a war criminal.
Right.
That doesn't
exactly
get reviewed.
Yeah, yeah.
I think this is true. I mean, what you were doing, of course, was attacking an entire assumption about the direction of history or even the nature of history. A lot of what you've done, and a lot of what Kissinger, for that matter, would have studied as preparatory to talking about the Congress of Vienna,
yeah,
was understanding how geography makes history and how history makes the present. When you were talking about Fukuyama and the post-Cold War moment, there was an assumption that history and geography could both be overcome, and Thomas Friedman would be, you know, the great popularizer of this. There is that assumption baked into the foundations, in many ways, of American culture,
and
an overcoming of the past and rewriting.
And into liberalism, in the sense that liberals believe in progress with a capital P, as if progress is an ideology. And though humankind continues to evolve and we live much better lives than we did a long time ago, progress is never direct. It zigs and it zags and it goes backwards at times before going forward again. And but again, I wasn't so much conscious of it at the time I wrote. I was merely describing what people said to me and what I thought. And I always believed that it's not just what people say, because they'll say something so a journalist will have a high opinion of them and write well of
Everybody believes in peace.
Yes, in other words, it's virtue signaling. It's cheap virtue signaling. Watch what excites them. Watch how they behave. Look if the streets are being cleaned in the morning in their neighborhood. You know, see how things work. If people show up on time, all these very unpleasant things that you're not supposed to notice and you're supposed to forgive, but which any financial analyst would notice in a second and make bets on.
Yeah,
you know, make bets, you know, in the stock market about on that country or this country.
So, the political class in the U.S. and also in Europe, as it now is, you're saying is disconnected from these functional realities and the nature of everyday life in the societies that they're ruling.
I think it goes deeper. I think it's as if liberals are always can be proven wrong, but because of the beauty of their ideas, they never have anything to worry about.
You can't argue against faith.
Right,
yeah. Yeah.
But conservatives have to be proven right by events. Because if the events turn out slightly differently than what they had predicted or intuited, their reputations are at risk. Because conservatism does not send a chill up your spine in a way that liberalism does. And that's the challenge of conservatism.
So if we look then at the pivotal events of 2001 and the American invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq that followed from the 9/11 attacks, you wrote a lot about empire in this period. You understood the American military move into the world in terms of historical empires and the geography of imperialism. Yeah. Was that a particularly popular approach to the matter, as opposed to moralizing or security questions?
No, here, look, I'm very unapologetic about this. The United States, since 1945, has in functional terms been an empire because it has the same challenges, frustrations, and tearing your hair out problems as empires in the past, be it Portuguese, Dutch, French, British, the various Hindu empires, the Iranian empires of old. Empire is not just modern European empires. If you're going to attack empire as a concept, you better be willing to attack of much of Iranian history, Indian history,
all
Chinese history, almost
yeah.
all Chinese yeah. history yeah. for that matter. So in functional terms, the United States since 1945 has had imperial responsibilities. Mm-hmm. And by 2001, it had developed a military with large numbers of special forces, multilingual, a navy that put, you know, that guarded the sea lines of communication and the choke points for hydrocarbons, and essentially protected allies and provided for globalization. I mean, Davos would not exist mm-hmm. without the U.S. Navy. And I've said this at Davos, and it's not popular, because globalization only exists because of safe and secure sea lines, which are mainly provided by the U.S. Navy mm-hmm. more than any other yep. navy. In that sense, the U.S. Navy has taken up where the British Royal Navy is left off. And so America, whether you're talking about its navy, its air force, its army, the political and foreign affairs problems that its diplomats have to deal with is very much imperial. Mm. And so I looked at 9/11 and I said that, you know, that Iraq will be an imperial invasion. I thought it would succeed. I was wrong. And what I do is I believe that whenever you're wrong on something big and you ever mention it in print, always mention how you got it wrong, which is the only way. So people should know, you know, people shouldn't forget what you got mm-hmm. wrong. They should always be aware of it, kind of. And what I got wrong in Iraq is something odd and specific, which is in the 80s, 90s, I was traveling periodically to Romania under Ceausescu up until 89. And I also visited Saddam Hussein's Iraq a number of times. Hmm. And to me, Iraq was like no other place in the Arab world. Going from Saddam's Iraq to Hafez al-Assad's Syria was like coming up for liberal humanist air. That's how much less mm-hmm. oppressive the Ba'athist regime in Syria was to the one in Iraq. And Iraq to me was the only thing I could compare it to was Ceausescu's Romania. And Ceausescu was toppled. There was 10 days of mild chaos. And Romania marched on. It survived. And I thought the same thing would happen in Iraq, and it wasn't the case.
There are two questions I would like to ask about
sure.
this. One of them is going back a little, which is about in order to manage imperial responsibilities, the empire has to develop an imperial ruling culture.
Yes.
And the kind of measured judgment required seems to have been present in the immediate post-war period. Someone like Kennan, for instance,
yeah.
and the containment theory and so on. Kissinger, even.
Yeah.
And there didn't seem to be that much of it around, certainly in the last 20 to 30 years. And the second thing is relating to this, is this practical question of what to do once you've taken over a state like Iraq. There were people calling for it to be broken up into ethnically viable lumps, in other words, which is how the British had originally conceived of it.
Right. They put it together that
exactly.
way.
Yeah. And one of the voices calling for that at the time, I believe, of all people, was Joe Biden.
Yes.
Who wrote in the Times on exactly
that
point.
He and Peter Galbraith, and I think one or two others. Mm. Yeah.
But this was very much not on the agenda, and it still isn't on the agenda. And in my understanding, this is one of the particular reasons why the failure in Iraq has produced so little of redeeming qualities, because that is a failure to acknowledge the realistic facts of the composition of a made-up state. Do you wonder if American universalism, American optimism about the human condition is at odds with the tragic understanding of history, which is what you need if you're going to be a cynic, in fact, about the use of power overseas?
Yeah, I think it was V.S. Naipaul who wrote, "It is through pessimism that men shape and improve the world." In other words, what he meant was constructive pessimism, seeing everything that could go wrong and worrying about it so that it would not go wrong. Getting back to the early part of your question, there was a generation in America after World War II which had seen World War II, had fought in it. They were a combination of veterans, of WASP pseudo-aristocrats who didn't have to worry about wealth or making money so that they can afford, and they often came from the heartland. Kennan came from Wisconsin, and that's a big part of who he was. Always remember that. And then you had the immigrants, the immigrant realists, Robert Strauss, Huppé, Hans Morgenthau, Zbigniew Brzezinski, and of course, Henry Kissinger, who knew the world as it really was, because they were immigrants, you know, they were refugees from chaos, from Nazism, from Stalinism. Yeah. And so they had a sense of the tragic. And the WASP aristocrats had a sense of proportion. They had a great sense of proportion. And you put the two together, and you get a class that could administer an empire, essentially. And nowadays, for all kinds of economic, sociological reasons, you have a generally, and I don't like to stereotype too much, but it's generally a ruling class that has never either seen military combat or been embedded or had any real experience with the military. They have gotten as far as they've gotten through merit, through high test scores, et cetera, and thus feel themselves to be deserving. And in their and generally have had no experience with tragedy. In other words, maybe in their individual lives they had, but not in a national sense. They had no sense of what war is really like. So that you have a class of people who are less able to have, I wouldn't call it the cynicism. I'd call it like the anxious foresight and constructive pessimism that Machiavelli wrote about, which is necessary to administer places or to heavily influence places of a very different culture than your own. Here's the basic fact where the American elites get it wrong. American elites believe that American history is applicable throughout the world. That America's historical, because America has had a happy experience with democracy. Therefore, every country in the world wants America's experience. And therefore, they discount the historical experiences of other people. For instance, what is culture? Culture is the experience of a large number of people in the same geographical space over hundreds and thousands of years. And this leads to behavioral habits, different kinds of art, writing, etc. The American view of the world, the Wilsonian view of the world, is very narcissistic and self-reverential. In the sense, you know, you'll be happier when you do as we say, another, when you adopt our system.
I wonder if also those who have looked outside and have looked at the history, an imperial history, maybe looking at the wrong case studies. After 9/11, there was a lot of references, in what neoconservative references, to the British Empire and so on. But when the America you're describing is closer to the late Roman Empire, for instance, that the British Empire, certainly in its organized 19th century style, there was very little distance between, say, the military and that small caste of people who were actually administrating things abroad and the domestic government. The ordinary people weren't greatly involved at all, but the managerial class was also the imperial class and also the military class. What you're describing is something closer to Rome in its decay, which is the outsourcing, in effect, of military service in return for passports, and the creation of a closed aristocracy, in effect, in the metropolis.
No, that's very true. Those are really all excellent points. I would say something else, that London and Paris are both the cultural and political capitals of their countries. So at dinner parties, you can have a diplomat sitting next to a poet, sitting next to a painter, sitting next to a politician, whereas Washington and New York are separate. New York is the cultural and financial capital, and Washington is the political capital. So people in Washington tend to be more Philistine. And people in New York tend to be very cultured and sophisticated, but have no knowledge and respect for the hard, difficult choices that policymakers have to make. They see the world in terms of moral, black and white moral absolutes. So there's a little bit of that, too, a geographical question, that if the two national capitals were fused better, you would have more sophisticated diplomats and an intellectual class that was more pragmatic, or at least more understanding of the difficult choices. I mean, I always find this when I go to New York, how people are very sophisticated until you put forward a real serious military or foreign policy crisis, and they reveal themselves to know very little about it. And to have no real understanding. I mean, in Washington, you can say, this person works for the intelligence community, and it's okay. If you say that in New York among certain circles, you're suspect.
Do you see a similar division between power centers when you look at the European Union, which was cited, its offices anyway, cited in Brussels, which is one of the least powerful locations in Europe, while its cultural and political life is, of course, spread between half a dozen major capitals?
Yeah. I think the European Union is an empire that doesn't work. And that's a shame, because if you're a Slovene or a Croat or a Serb or an Albanian, you want the empire to work. So it will grow and eventually take you in completely and will be like a roof, a common roof over all your national ethnic problems, so that you could solve them in the context of a benevolent empire. To which you're all a member. I mean, these countries in Central Eastern Europe have no future except within a European Union. And of course, as we know, the European Union, this necessary empire that I call it, is not doing well at all. I mean, because of a lot of things, you know, some of it that things are too, you have Frankfurt, which is essentially the financial capital, you have other.
I mean, it's true. These countries cannot preserve their independence from Russia without the umbrella, say, of the European Union.
They can't get along with each other. Mm. They can't really solve their problems with each other except under the umbrella of the EU.
The problem, of course, being that the EU has stalled in terms of its development since 2005. It's the attempt to build that overarching roof, that sort of geodesic dome over old Europe, has simply stalled and has started to fall backwards in a way. I mean, Brexit is, a vote of no confidence in everything that the European Union has come to stand for.
Yeah, and there's also the problem of the euro itself, because Greece has been irresponsible. Italy has been irresponsible. Macron seems to be unable to carry through with necessary reforms because he's politically not experienced enough. Britain, as you say, is opting out. And so the real question for Europe becomes, how long will the German voter stand for this? you know, or there will come a time when there is a more nationalistic chancellor of Germany. And nationalism in Germany could take various forms. It could become neo-isolationist, you know, wanting as little to do with all these troubled countries. It could become pro-Russian. When you consider that a former German chancellor is essentially a Russian agent. He's essentially a Russian agent. And everyone in Germany knows this. It could, you know, or there could be more tensions with France. The tragedy of Britain leaving the EU is that as long as Britain was in the EU, there was a balancer to Germany, not just in political military terms, but in the sense that the German-French economic philosophy was always more statist than the British economic philosophy. So there was a nice balance. It was a real nice, but when Britain leaves and France is faltering, you know, we're left to the devices of Germany.
Which is the country running a massive surplus in the Eurozone and profiting by the current disorder, in fact.
Yeah, Germany is to Europe what China is to the world, in a sense. And so it all ultimately depends on the maturity of the German voter. That's what it all comes down to.
That's a worrying prospect in
some senses. Yeah, it is, but that's what it ultimately comes down to. You know, luckily the Germans continue to be boring. You know, the new chancellor heir apparent seems like, you know, a clone of Angela Merkel. But but Angela Merkel, remember, speaks Russian. She grew up in East Germany. She has a sensibility about dealing with Russia, with Central Eastern Europe, that her new clone, Annegret Kramp-Karrenbauer, I can't pronounce it all right. Many Germans can't pronounce it all right. Will lack this kind of background.
So the absence of expertise, historical perspective, is a common pattern. What produced this? I mean, you said there were several complicated factors, but, you know, to simplify them, a short list, what produced this emptying out of understanding and capacity?
Of wisdom. Mm. What produced it was the very economic success for decades upon decades in Europe and the United States that produced a class of people who were both financially secure and physically secure. They were like the first generation or two in history that didn't have to worry about their survival, whether economic or physical. They were cushioned, they were protected, they were ahistorical, in other words. And therefore, they lived with philosophy rather than with history. Mm. And philosophy has all these beautiful theories about peace and democracy, you know, the whole Kantian kind of pantheon. And you know, history is for those who have had bad experiences in life. Mm-hmm. And so you have a generation that, in a technocratic sense, is very well-equipped, very competent, well-equipped, but they just don't have the judgment that comes from having actually lived through hard times and being nervous about it. I mean, what is the key to Henry Kissinger's wisdom generally? He was a refugee from Nazi Germany. His early formative teenage years was to see Nazi thugs in the street. You cannot disaggregate that from his studies at Harvard and elsewhere, and his particular talents that he brought as a statesman. Take away that aspect of his early life, and it's not Henry Kissinger, you know. And the elite that we of our generation and one before, the one coming into power, have nothing resembling that. Nothing even close.
There are two things I would say to that. One of them, I was wondering how much of what people call populism is simply a message from the real world. from real experience, being democratically delivered by the only means that people have, which is to vote out of disgust as much as any optimism. And the other thing is the case which you did refer to in The Coming Anarchy and have written about, which is of a people choosing to return to history, as it were, which is the case of Turkey, which is a country which has stood and been insulted even at the gates of the European Union and is clearly not going to get membership and has instead turned away towards being a much more religious society, pursuing a foreign policy that's been described even as neo-Ottoman.
Yeah. Neo-Ottomanism actually began with Turgut Özal in the early 1980s, but Özal was a decent man who loved Ronald Reagan, loved the United States. He just believed in the benevolent factors of the Ottoman Empire. But it started with him, and Erdogan, a very different character, picked it up. I think, yes. Look, in 1848, all the great liberals, the liberal reformers, were nationalists. Mm-hmm. All right. Because now, in a different technological era, where generations of wealth have created this upper middle class, whiskey-sipping global elite, who have more loyalty to their friends across the ocean than within their own Absolutely. Continent or 10 miles away, and have more in common with them. Mm-hmm. You have elites that are not national. They're international elites. And therefore, their ties to the homeland are lessened, are very much lessened. Mm-hmm. And meanwhile, you have the bulk of the rest of the population, whether it's in Hungary, it's in the United States, it's in England, who have been just left behind. So that what you have is globalization, in other words, has rather than united the world, has split these places in half. Mm-hmm. America has been split down the middle because of globalization, because there's the part of the population that competes well, that's good looking, is talented, does well on test scores, they get great jobs, they send their kids abroad to Europe. Mm-hmm. And then there's the other, two-thirds of the population, which for various means cannot compete, in this global, world of severe, this dog-eat-dog, highly competitive mm-hmm. global world. And so this is the backlash that we're having. Now, in the mid-19th century, nationalists were liberals. Now, nationalists are reactionary because all the liberals graduated out of their own country mm-hmm. into this international mm-hmm. global elite.
And it's easy to talk about it purely in material terms, for instance, wage stagnation.
Yeah.
But there are also very important cultural factors in this.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, another reason for the backlash being specifically nationalist. But it is about people trying to maintain what is left to them, in fact, after their lives have become meaningless in material terms, which are things like community, familiarity, language, and so on. When you were traveling in the world in the 90s and the early 2000s, and you were seeing the return, really, of these ghostly empires, what writers were you looking to in terms of people who had been before you in these situations and interpreted them? Were you thinking like of Rebecca West in the Balkans, for instance?
In each place, it was different. Because what I tend to do, and I learned this early, was history doesn't begin in a place the day you arrive. It's got 35 chapters beforehand. Mm. So read history, don't read political science, and read fiction. Because in the guise of fiction, a writer can more bravely tell the truth. Because he can always say, well, I don't believe this. It's just my character who believes it. So read mm-hmm. read really good fiction. Rebecca West was only one of them, really. There were many others. I found that a novelist that really kind of... that really had a sense of the unpleasant sides of Africa was V.S. Naipaul and his mm-hmm. brother Shiva mm-hmm. Naipaul as well. But it was mainly a lot of local, minute local histories. It wasn't travel writers so much. And of course, like I like to say, going back to The Coming Anarchy, wait long enough and you'll be proven wrong. You know, or, you know, it, whether you're proven right or wrong depends on the news cycle, essentially. You know, there are all these young writers now who are predicting another cataclysm in the Balkans. I don't believe it. I think in the Balkans today, the fighting has continued except for the shooting. And it will continue like that until either the EU incorporates them in some respect. But you won't have another war. Because there's not the energy, there's not the arms or the munitions. There's not going to be another war there. And Africa, sub-Saharan Africa, is it's a mixture. You have high dramatic growth rates, economically speaking, in Ethiopia and Tanzania and Mozambique. You have disappointing political situation in southern Africa. You have West Africa, which has gone nowhere, essentially. Mm-hmm. It's at peace, but it's gone nowhere. There's no manufacturing base that's developing to stabilize the place. And then you have the deep forests of Central Africa going from southern Sudan right into throughout the Congo, where nothing has happened. So it's different wherever you go in Africa. It's
very different. And in North Africa, in the Maghreb, you have a different story as well, which was another crucial miscalculations of foreign policy establishment, which was the very notion of there being an Arab Spring.
The Arab Spring was about a crisis in central authority, which said nothing about whether these countries were or were not prepared for democracy. Their existing orders became illegitimate. And so there had to be a change. But between that and democracy could be 500 years of development. What are the Arab countries that work relatively well now? Morocco, Jordan, Oman especially. What do they all have in common?
They're monarchies.
They're all monarchies, and they're all enlightened dictatorships. Mm-hmm. So it's enlightened dictatorship tends to work in the Arab world. Tunisia, everyone said, well, that's a democratic success story. And I'd say, leave Tunis. Go throughout the southern reaches of the country. It's much more chaotic. And what one of the reasons that made Tunisia relatively healthy to have a social and economic basis was an enlightened dictator, Habib Bourguiba, who's like, along with David Ben-Gurion and Kemal Atatürk, one of the great minor men of the 20th century. And the two of us would include Patrick Lee Fermor in that as well. But Habib Bourguiba, even Zine El Abidine Ben Ali developed a middle class. He became corrupt, terribly corrupt. He was toppled. But he grew the middle class in the country. And that's one of the reasons why Tunisia has not collapsed.
So using democracy as a metric in itself is a big mistake. You're saying that that's an end result, not the process itself.
Democracy is the icing on the cake. I mean, in my experience, you need a reasonably successful middle class. You need ethnic or tribal or sectarian conflict to be at a manageable minimum, essentially. And because here's the problem. If you hold a democracy in a country that has no middle class, really, or a very weak middle class, but you do have sectarian and ethnic divides, political parties will emerge based on those divides. So you will only intensify the ethnic divides through the political parties. What you need is more benign reasons for disagreement, such as a middle class, a complex class structure, so people could choose up political parties based on other differences that are not ethnic, not sectarian.
Those differences in American domestic politics are getting narrower and narrower.
Yes. The
last question I wanted to ask was that, you know, much of the coming anarchy has come, and there's obviously plenty more of it on the way. What do you see American politics being like in, say, 5 years' time?
Well, I'm very worried that the United States was a great inspiring democracy in the print and typewriter age, but it's unclear it can continue as such in the digital and video era, because people are intaking information. They're absorbing information in a radically different form than they did in the print and typewriter age, so that the very maturity this, you know, the emotional and intellectual maturity of the average American voter is much less than it used to be, I would argue. I don't believe there's a going back completely to a pre-Trump era if he mm-hmm. leaves office. Yeah. I think it's impossible to imagine Donald Trump except in a digital video age, not just because of the tweets, but the way in which he absorbs information so that he's a man who's post-literate. He's made an end run around literacy, which means mm-hmm. he has no understanding of America's alliances, the legacy of World War II and the Cold mm-hmm. War. This all means nothing to him.
Would you say that Barack Obama then was the last of the old style presidents in the sense that he came from this technocratic, managerial, book reading, scholarly
elite? Yeah, I would. But I would say something else, though, which is that if you look at all American Cold War presidents, from Harry Truman to George H.W. Bush, and then you compare them to all the post-Cold War presidents, starting with Bill Clinton going all the way to Donald Trump, you would find a tremendous drop in the quality of leadership mm-hmm. from the first group to the second group. They all have differences with each other within each group, but generally, the first group were much more impressive as leaders than the second group. And I think the Cold War enforced the discipline. You were in where things mattered, where foreign policy mattered. Someone told me, who's very knowing and high up in government, that the Republican Party never would have allowed George W. Bush to get the nomination if it was during the height of the Cold War. You know, that would not mm-hmm. have happened. Mm. There was a sense that things were less at risk, kind of. And I'm not a hater of George W. Bush. He dramatically improved relations with India, did other things. It wasn't all just the Iraq War. But generally, there's been a serious decline in American leadership.
Would you say, I mean, to close out, would you say that that is as much a threat as the external questions, you know, that occupy foreign policy establishments' thinking? For instance, the rise of China, or the Thucydides trap, as it's been called, that it's actually, as with previous empires, the disintegration begins at home, at the top, rather than outside.
Yeah, it does. I think we're seeing it at the top. We're also seeing it outside, in the sense that the world is less manageable than it used to be. It's less of a top. There was a late great American political scientist, Kenneth Waltz, who said that the opposite of anarchy is hierarchy. Not order, but hierarchy. Because as long as you had hierarchy, you had order. All order in the world, order within professions, order within artistic tastes, starts with a hierarchy, from the best mm-hmm. or the most powerful down to the least. And the organizing principle of today's world is the destruction of hierarchies, whether it's political, whether it's social, whether it's sexual, between men at the top, women in the bottom. Wherever you go, there's a collapsing of hierarchies. Mm-hmm. And that is at the root of the disorder we face now.
Robert Kaplan, thank you very much.
It was my pleasure.
And you've been listening to me, Dominic Green, casting the pod with him, Robert Kaplan, on The Green Room, Spectator USA's Life and Arts podcast. You can find us, you can like us, you can even opinionate us wherever you get your podcasts from. You can look for us on iTunes under Spectator USA. Join us next week. Until then, thank you for listening. Goodbye.